And so you have a tension there between the people on the south side of the island and the people on the north side of the island. Eric Garner was killed on the north side of the island. Most of the minorities are located on the north side of the island. However, three out of every five New York City police officers reside in Staten Island. And so when you look at situations where Daniel Donovan, the DA at the time, getting promoted now to Congress, and he runs this entire race without mentioning Eric Garner hardly at all. We're looking at situations where on that island now, because politically you want to appease the police officers that reside there, you know, Debbie Rose is endorsing Mike McMahon, who is the new DA. At the same time, while you have Pat Lynch, the president of the Police Benevolent Association of the police union, endorsing the same man. It's an incestuous cesspool of kind of cover-ups and double dealing there. You know, the Democrats on Staten Island are no better than the Republicans.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask Erica, as you speak about Congress, are you thinking of running for Congress, Erica Garner?
What I want to do is I want to organize the black and brown vote on Staten Island. I want to knock on doors. I want to ask the people of Staten Island about their issues firsthand, because no one is talking about, you know, what's going on in Staten Island. So, if I do decide to run for Congress, I want to, you know, be one of those elected officials that get into office and don't turn their backs on people. I want to be one who wants to hold people accountable and get the corrupted out. I want to be able to treat the same way how they treat whistleblowers. I want to be able to point out the corrupted elected officials and get them out.
And what are your plans, Ramsey?
Plans is keep spreading the word, cop watch, and make sure everybody has knowledge. And
you're going to keep filming?
Yeah, I'm going to keep filming.
I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll continue this conversation afterwards and put it online at democracynow.org. Ramsey Orta, Erica Garner, Reggie Harris. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Well, it was Democracy Now! My name is Finn, and I host a show called Finn's Revolution at 7 p.m. It is 6 p.m., which, of course, can only mean one thing. But just before we get to that, at 7 p.m., I'm going to be playing a couple of hours of Bowie. Not really talking, but a couple of hours. So if you want to tune into that, you can. And also, if you would like to make some requests, you can hit me on my Facebook page, which is Finn Miller. That's F-I-N-N Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R, and make those requests and do that. But in the meanwhile, as I said, it is 6:01 p.m. right here on WUSB Stony Brook. And that, of course, can only mean one thing.
Thank you. Es handelt sich um eine völlig neue Generation in der Computertechnologie.
Und wem nützt sie?
Uns allen, wenn es nach mir geht.
Let's Netz, der Chaos Talk. Technik, Web, Politik.
sbg.chaostreff.at. The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only live on for the best, expect the worst. I hope that's understood. One did we know?
Herzlich willkommen bei Chaos Talk, Let's Netz, der Chaos Talk. Wir begrüßen heute zwei sehr spezielle Gäste aus den USA, weswegen ich ab jetzt auf Englisch reden werde. Hello, my special guests from the USA. We're welcoming here Kyle.
Hi there.
And Emmanuel Goldstein.
I'm so glad you changed languages. Thank you.
Let me welcome you here in Salzburg today.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
It's good to be here.
I should mention that you've got your own radio shows.
We do. Yeah. We have two shows.
Terrific. So you're totally used to this setting and probably much less nervous than I am.
Yeah, I'm a little nervous, but that's mostly because I'm here in Salzburg.
Let me just say, we're not used to this setting. This is a really fantastic radio station you have here, and we're really impressed. It's a lot different than the facilities we're used to, but... Oh. Radio is the same, I guess, across all continents.
Thank you very much. So let's make a short introduction. So Kyle, what do you do for a living?
Yeah, I do as much as possible. I'm a staff photographer and an artist with 2600 Magazine, and I also handle infrastructure and special projects. I'm also the co-coordinator for the HOPE conferences.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's a really big event that 2600 sponsors. So that's the brunt of my work.
We've hit here already a lot of words that our listeners might not be able to understand. So let me first welcome Emmanuel Goldstein.
Hello.
The founder of the 2600, the Hacker Quarterly magazine.
We call it 2600, but people in Europe call it 2600. I'm also one of the coordinators of the HOPE conference, and that keeps me busy.
What is HOPE?
Yeah, can you please explain
HOPE
what the
is,
HOPE is?
It's a biannual, is that the right word?
There's a difference between biannual
and biannual. One is twice a year and one is two times every 2 years. Mm-hmm. No, once every 2 years. We're a little confused. Our conference is once every 2 years, and it's called HOPE Hackers on Planet Earth.
And what that is an acronym for Hackers on Planet Earth. So we call it HOPE for short.
And every HOPE conference has a different name. Last one, for instance, was HOPE X because it was the 10th HOPE. And the one before that was HOPE number 9. And we try to keep it imaginative.
Much in the spirit of, the themes that go along with some of the chaos events in Germany, we like to keep every event different. And honestly, it comes from the content. It comes from what's kind of going on in the culture. But we then can bring, I guess, a new spirit to it every time.
Much of our inspiration has come from the chaos events because the content that is covered, the diversity of people, we're told that we have the most European conference in the States, and that makes us happy.
So by now it should be clear that you're both hackers, right?
Yeah, we can admit to that, we are, but in the good sense.
All right, so you would classify yourself as a white hat hacker? Or?
No, because I hate that phrase.
Okay.
I hate, I like hats, but I hate being referred to by a particular color hat or a particular color anything. Basically, hackers are hackers. Some do good things, some do bad things, some do good and bad things. But there isn't really a class of people out there that are the good hackers versus the bad hackers, like on some television show. It's just something that I think the media and the industry create so that they can sell things a lot easier.
So you both have just recently been to the Chaos Computer Congress in Hamburg, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you feel there that it's generally despised being a hacker and working for governmental institutions like secret services or such?
Oh, absolutely. I think there'd be quite a bit of criticism for people that did things like that. It's, you know, it's bad enough that people work for big corporations, but to actually work for an agency of some sort that is intent on doing the community harm, that's almost unforgivable. It's something that I think we experience the same thing at Hope. It's part of the conversation. We need to talk about it. We need to talk to the people involved, but we don't have much sympathy for people who work against what it is that we stand for.
Isn't the climate very different in the U.S.?
It's different in some ways. You'll find a lot of the same questions and topics are being discussed. And it's less political in the U.S. as Germany has always had a very political hacker scene, but I think it's changed. I think with what Snowden has done, with the Manning revelations, with WikiLeaks, people realize that it's all related, it's all connected, and politics is an essential part of it, and it's not in any way taking away from the technology.
I would just add that I think it is a little bit more accepted. The people who are involved in security, not our event in particular per se, maybe someone could argue otherwise, but I think we're kind of right up there with the European attitude in a lot of ways, at least from us as from our standpoint as organizers. But there are events in the States, and the general attitude that kind of goes along with what you said, with people working and doing a lot of, all kinds of things for corporations. There's a lot of people that do work in government agencies and work every day for security and in those places, and aren't necessarily as passionate about the political side and the social impact of their work.
I would assume that you might know quite a lot of people who work for security services in person.
Yeah, I mean, I've met at Hope, I think a couple people. We did an interesting couple phone calls, some humorous social engineering stuff where we were calling some various agencies and stuff like that, and a lot of really positive support. People that, you know, they said, hey, I work here, you know, and you know they helped us in, you know, finding ways to get in touch with different places. And you kind of, you know, wave, you respect your boundaries and these kinds of things, but I'm not really affiliated, or I don't really associate myself personally with those individuals.
They're definitely out there. A lot of fans of the magazine that it's a guilty pleasure, both coming to Hope and reading 2600. So they support us in their way, but obviously we're on two different paths, you know, and sometimes it's kind of hard to see the similarities.
But you know, as we said, I mean, we feel the same way about people that just sort of blindly accept some job or position with a corporation that's doing as much with these government agencies. There's plenty of administrators and developers with Microsoft, Apple, Google, you name it, Amazon, all of them, or just ISPs, right? I mean, there's a lot of people that work at internet exchanges and on ISPs that have clearance, or they have to basically get along with people that are coming in there and using the networks, using the infrastructure in ways that maybe other people wouldn't necessarily accept, but they accept it as the course of their work working for that company, and that's a choice they make. You know, we all have these choices to make. But we all kind of coexist as well. And I think at least we can provide the venue for everyone to be there and everyone to have the conversation. And that's the important part, is the dialogue, creating the venue for that. Because if we're not talking about these things, people aren't aware. They might just accept these things without considering how their peers might feel about them if they knew what they did, for instance, in their day-to-day job or with a government or something.
So you really phoned in at those services?
Yes. Well, not a... let's just say someone we know called in.
Okay.
Yeah. That's pretty much what happened.
Cool. Is it available online or somewhere? Is there a recording of it?
There.
Well, this we're talking about the social engineering panel at the Hackers on Planet Earth conference, HopeX. Yeah, it's all there.
So HopeX was the last one?
Yes.
So I can assume that Hope as a conference exists for 20 years now?
Yes. The first one was in 1994.
Impressive.
That one was called Hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had no other name for it then. Then the one after that was called Beyond Hope. And we've continued since then to keep coming up with different names for every conference up until HopeX, and we're still trying to think of what to call the next one.
So was this even before the first conference in the Netherlands?
No, the conference in the Netherlands that I went to in 1989 was Galactic Hacker Party.
Oh, right.
And then I went to a camp in 1993, I believe, called Hacking at the End of the Universe, HEU. And that inspired me to pursue a conference like this in the States. Before then, the only conferences that took place in the States were basically friends, maybe a couple of dozen people at most that would meet in a motel and hang out in a bar, perhaps. But Hope in 1994 was the first conference in the United States to bring in over 1,000 people. It was unheard of. And typical to the projects that we endeavor, everyone told us it's impossible. It'll never happen in the States. It's not like the Netherlands. You can't do this. And not only did we do it, we did it in the middle of Manhattan for everybody to see. And that's where we've been ever since.
Very impressive.
So I would like to play some music.
All right, let's have some music. Yeah. Thank you. Welcome back. After this short piece of music, again, we are here with our very special guests from the US, Kyle and Emmanuel.
Hello.
Hi.
So, as we said, you've got your own radio shows. So
we do. We most definitely do. Yes, we have Off the Wall and Off the Hook.
Okay.
Off the Hook has been on the air longer, and it's on the bigger radio station. It's about phone freaking and computer hacking and technology in general, and Off the Wall is more or less Kyle and myself ranting and raving about society.
How often is it? Once a week?
Once a week, yes.
And maybe you want to tell our listeners where they can find the show, or even the stream, probably?
Yes, you can find both shows, and also shows that I've done in the past as well, on www.2600.com. That's 2600.com. And you'll see a section for radio, and you'll see an off-the-hook section, an off-the-wall section, and a few other sections as well.
What kind of music are you playing in those shows?
Oh, gosh, what kind of music don't we play, Kyle? We play all sorts of things, don't we?
Yeah.
Commercial or CC licensed?
We kind of do both because we don't really try to think too much about something we like. If we like a sound, then we'll play it. Our stations pay whatever fees are demanded of them from ASCAP, etc. So being on the FM dial, we're able to play commercial music as well. I know it gets a little bit cloudier on the internet, and we're hoping all that gets worked out somehow, because it's really an impediment to creativity if you have to think about, okay, who published this song before you play it. If we like a sound, we just generally go with it.
Yeah, we do have a bit of a unique perspective on it. It's actually to a point, I think, where people are very, very fearful, and then Creative Commons comes in as a solution, and we're aware there are actually entire productions, entire shows that are all Creative Commons, and those artists absolutely are doing great things by releasing their material, and it is kind of a important paradigm, a new way to handle copyright, because it is so very broken right now, and there are a lot of really interesting things people are doing about this. I know one of the things I saw 31C3 was Julia Retta's talk on writing copy wrongs, which was a really, really fantastic talk, and she's an amazing parliament member in the EU and is working very hard on that. So,
but you know, if those copy wrongs aren't righted in the near future, I'd support some kind of technology, maybe somebody out there can invent this, that would make it impossible to play a commercial bit of music with copyrights and all sorts of restrictions on a digital device, because they seem to really have trouble with the digital world. They don't want their material to be copied and shared, and that's what digital technology is, copying and sharing. So if we just simply make it so only Creative Commons music can be played on digital devices or over radio stations, then problem solved. You guys go back to vinyl, you play everything analog, you make sure everyone pays every time they play something, and nobody shares anything, and I think we'll all be happy.
I beg your pardon?
Well, it's my modest proposal for solving the problem.
This just sounded like you proposed DRM?
Well, no. Their DRM. I'm proposing what they want for their material. So the commercial music, live in your restricted world, and we won't even listen to your music anymore. We'll listen to the Creative Commons music, and we'll share, and we'll copy, and we'll have a lot of fun.
I do know what you want to say, but wouldn't in practice this require some kind of DRM technology?
No, it would just require them to stay the hell off of digital devices. That's all. That's all they have to do.
It's what they want anyway, right? I mean, we think it's funny. It's you got to have a sense of humor, because there are various. I mean, people take this stuff incredibly seriously, and it's really just like, well, let's separate the worlds. If they're so, I mean, don't poison what cool things you can do with digital technology.
Yes.
If you must inject your profit and profit seeking into every new platform and every song that's out there, because it really does create fear. And
I can't even begin to describe all of the restrictions and how they have hurt the simple things such as playing music over the radio or having somebody hum a song in a film. You have to get permission for each and everything, and it's different for every country. So you have to do something here, but then do something different for someplace else. It's great for lawyers. It's great for copyright attorneys and all of that. but it's really, really bad for artists. The people who wrote those songs, the people who perform those songs, they don't benefit from any of this. So we need to change that. We really need to make dramatic changes because it's not healthy what's happening.
Do you regard yourself as a lobby group for those topics?
I wouldn't say a lobby group. I consider ourselves part of the media. We're journalists. We're people that discuss things. Obviously, we have a slant, but every journalist does have a slant. We're just a little bit more honest in admitting that we have a slant. And we talk to a lot of people who are involved in lobbying, and we interview them on the radio, and it's important to hear these perspectives. But for us, we're getting word out of things that it's not being covered in the mainstream media.
And it's about pointing out the kind of absurdity of what it then does to creatives. And that's what we like doing. We like producing. We like doing fun things with audio and production, whether it's visually or with sound and music and stuff like that. So aside from technical stuff that a lot of people have to do, just getting their material together and funding for production and all of that, then you start getting into the difficulties of legal stuff. That just, it really does inhibit it, because you're making people fearful, and people ought not to be afraid of remixing, producing stuff, mashing stuff around and having fun. It should be fun. It shouldn't be that you're taking on a label every time you want to mix in something cool with your talk show or with a movie you made or something this way.
Do you have an audio example for what we could play in our show for having fun with music?
Well, anything from Negative Land, certainly.
Yeah.
Those guys are always messing with copyright and powerful attorneys and things like that. The letter U and the number 2 is a song they did many years ago involving U2 and Casey Kasem and copyright and all that. Of course, I think they got sued for it anyway. It's hard. It's hard, especially in this climate, to just do this sort of thing. But I think if more people didn't go along with it, that would make a big difference. We hear these ridiculous rules and we fall over ourselves trying to figure out, okay, how do we comply? Let's stop complying. Let's start challenging and doing it anyway. If you're an artist and you're not allowed to create a piece that has excerpts from something else, create the piece anyway. You just don't have to release it, but at least create it and be creative. And one day, hopefully something will change and you'll be able to share it. Or somebody might hack into your computer and take it and then share it.
Is it Creative Commons?
U2? I mean, not U2, Negative Land.
Two, yeah, the song Two.
Probably not. No, I don't think so.
All right.
There's a band that comes to mind off Imputer Records, which is a Seattle label, and around the time a lot of the copyright stuff was starting with digital music, they released or they hosted a band on their label called DJs on Strike, and they released a whole bunch of mixes that were basically mashups of MP3s and stuff, completely augmented and, you know, played with, yeah, electronically into, you know, turning it into hardcore, kind of like Sex does on and Kid 606, some of those guys. But they were able to just make that statement, and they were putting stickers out of DJs that they felt were commercial, you know, and that were doing these things. And basically, they said that they were banned from Antarctica and they couldn't be held accountable for copyright laws because the imprint was based in Antarctica. And they obscured their voices and you couldn't tell who they were or what they were doing. And they distributed the album via Imputer. Something else that comes to mind in light of that is like Beardy Man. He's a beatboxer who's started up recently. He's from the UK, and he's a comedian too, and he basically built an entire machine to help him do live looping and sequencing. And if you ever listen to some of his work, he's really incredible. He basically makes fun of a lot of artists. He'll parody people. He'll do like Elton John, or he'll do any number of artists. He'll sound exactly like them because he can make any sound. He can do effects. He'll do the Stephen Hawking. But, you know, there's some really great great performances from Beardy Man.
That's another thing. Parody. Parody is something you should never have to ask permission for. You just do it. You want to make fun of somebody, you make fun of them. But too many people are worried about, well, what if I get sued? What if I offend somebody? If you're a comedian, you should be offending somebody. You know, it's part of what it's all about. There are people who will tell you can't take a picture of a building. It's copyrighted. Taking a picture of a building on a public street is copyrighted. This is what the legal minds of our time are coming up with. And they'll keep going if we don't stop them. They have written, if you look at some of the contracts, you will see that they've already planned for interstellar travel. And they say in this and any other universe, that is actually a phrase in many legal documents because they've already thought about what happens when we meet aliens and they want to play a Beatles song. They're going to have to pay. This is the insanity.
Oh, my God. How
and
hilarious.
It is insanity. And we just have to not be afraid to say that.
Oh, my God.
But you didn't hear that from me.
But it is, it's being being strong. You know, we recognize, you know, as I said, there's important stuff with the Creative Commons movement. But we must also realize that we can't be relegated. You know, you're giving up something, the spontaneity. You're giving that up and you're saying, oh, well, we're going to play a small game and we'll be over here and don't hurt us. You know, you big, scary corporation. That's nice, but it is a fearful, it is a weak standpoint when you're actually talking about the kinds of crap that those companies put out and shove down your children's throats. That how many CDs you bought when you were little, you know, we bought and paid for, and the music and the kinds of we've come up with, yeah, like rap music, right? Misogyny, swearing, like all of these things in the 90s basically shaped a lot of young minds, right? And if you look at violence and attitudes towards women and gender, it's problematic what that does psychologically. We cannot forget that media shapes ideologies in society. We are the product of what is sold to us. That's why propaganda is so dangerous. That's why it is a very, very powerful medium, whether it is audio or music or written word, books. So to that end, it's scary, like in one way with like being the specter of maybe going up against a label, but they're scared. They're scared that the medium can make everything portable. They're afraid that they're not going to get money. I mean, these are profit-seeking ventures.
Right.
It's awful that they're able to wield the law at people, but that is only valid if we validate it, right? So, getting back to our shows, I've only been sort of doing work with Off the Hook and Off the Wall, and maybe the last like 4 or 5 years, I listened to Emmanuel's show when I was like, oh man, like very little, like it was some of the early regular radio that I listened to, and it was through being a listener and hearing some of the music you were doing, going back and listening to the early like dubs. You were having so much fun at the station.
I had no idea anybody was listening.
But that inspired me, and you know, when I was in school learning about production, learning about theory, and as well as how you could just play and express yourself, and the power of sharing that with people. And it was never ever something I thought would be possible that I could help out and be a part of it. So I think in the last couple of years we've probably played a little more electronic music, but that has a lot to do with the kind of music that I like.
Bunch of dubstep, we've got that.
Yeah. I'm probably guilty for a lot of the dubstep we play.
So Emmanuel, as you said, you had no idea somebody was listening. Do you have any numbers on how many people are listening in to your shows?
No, I could just say if everybody in the New York area was listening at the same time, it would be over 10 million, but I don't think that's realistic.
But do you have counters for like the stream? Or?
Well, actually, I don't have access to those machines myself, and I think the people that do have access probably don't keep track, at least not that much, because our stations basically aren't based on listenership. And if they were, then that would be competitive, and people would say, I have more listeners than you. So they kind of keep that out of our hands. But I do know a lot of people listen to Off the Hook. I do know
that. It's probably one of the most popular and famous radio shows in the hackersphere at all. So, which is surprises me quite a lot that you have no idea at all how many listeners you have.
Yeah, you know, I just know we have enough. We have people that come up to us and say, "Hey, I heard your show," and that's great. It's not a question of numbers. You know, I don't care how many Twitter followers I have. I don't care how many listeners I have. As long as the right people are listening and getting something out of it and that we're serving that community. But it is really a kind of a magical thing to know that you're speaking to people out there. And I also think it's amazing that the hacker community has embraced radio the way it has, because that's something that's always been passionate to me, having gone to school and basically majored in the radio station, because instead of going to class, I went to the radio station and just kind of messed around there all the time. And to me, radio has always been something magical because a lot is left to the imagination. You can describe something. You can play music and change somebody's life. You can take phone calls. There are so many things you can do. And to see that world merge with the other world that I'm involved in, that of computer hackers, simply incredible.
Yes, it's magic. So after talking so much about music, I'd suggest we play some now for ourselves.
Now, we're up to our long-distance dedication.
You're listening to a special edition of Off the Wall. Our friends in Austria are now playing a song that we can't play over the air in the United States from Negative Land, but it's a good opportunity to tell you what it is you are listening to. This is a radio program we recorded for another radio station over in Salzburg, Austria, at a station called Radio Fabrik. This aired in January of 2015. And now, back to the show.
Es handelt sich um eine völlig neue Generation in der Computertechnologie.
Und wem nützt sie?
Uns allen, es an ihr geht.
Let's Netz, der Chaos Talk.
Jeden vierten Mittwoch im Monat von 22 bis 23 Uhr. So, welcome back, Kyle and Emmanuel.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Our very special guests from the U.S., directly and freshly imported.
I wouldn't say direct and fresh. We've been traveling for about a month now.
You've been visiting all over Europe, right?
Yeah, we've been wandering around to some interesting places, not so commonly traveled, places like Budapest and Bratislava, and it's been pretty awesome.
It is fresh, though. When we come here, we get kind of a shot of energy. We get excited because there's so many different things, and we're on our toes. Obviously, traveling is it can be work sometimes.
But
stressful.
When did you arrive in Europe? To the Congress directly? Or?
Yes, right before the Congress. I think on the 26th of December is when we arrived, and we just
in
went.
In Hamburg.
Yeah, in Hamburg. We went straight to the conference and stayed there for about a week and then ventured out.
We had no set plan originally. That's kind of the way we've traveled in the past. So
didn't even buy a return ticket. And everybody at home thought we were crazy. Yeah, a one-way ticket to Europe, and we don't know when we're coming back.
Freaking anarchists.
It's great.
But it's flexible, you know? That's the best way. I mean, I've learned definitely from your experience, and I've really enjoyed it. It's a cool way to be agile. You can pick up and say, all right, well, we'll go here. And with a lot of the tech, I mean, with access points, free Wi-Fi, these things, it's a lot easier to make your plans while you're moving. Smartphones, all these things help a lot. So
sometimes they hurt. Sometimes they screw things up, but mostly they help.
Yes, it can be painful sometimes when technology is fighting back.
Google Maps doesn't believe in metros for some reason. So when you try and find your way around a certain city, they'll tell you how to do it by tram, but not by metro, which is much easier. Mm. So I don't know what that's all about.
Yeah, so some of the integration with transit systems just is not there yet. Even though they know the system and it's fixed in a lot of ways, we don't have quite the fluidity that, you know, you still have to think. You still have to actually walk up and look at the map and wrap your brain around it. So
yeah, I don't ever want to be a slave to that technology anyway. It's good to be able to figure it out on your own. And when we got to a new city, we basically look over the maps, find out how much it costs to get a pass so that we don't have to buy tickets to everything. And then we learn the system. We explore. We make mistakes. We go out the wrong entrance. And we basically get better every day.
All right.
And get lost.
That's we get lost.
Basic.
We've had so much fun getting lost.
That's actually some of the funnest stuff we do is getting completely lost, going to a part of town no one goes to, and walking around and checking it out.
Was this your first Congress at the CCC in Hamburg?
Yes.
Yes.
CCH. CCC. They changed it anyway.
Yeah.
So how did you manage to get lost there?
Oh, how do you not get lost there? That place is so big. I think I finally figured out after the conference ended, when there weren't so many people around, I just walked through all the rooms and said, okay, that is where that is, and that connects here. And it was difficult, but I guess necessary for the number of people that showed up, but it felt too big at times.
Yeah, I learned it quickly, but I was still getting completely disoriented. But I think the best way to think of it as two very huge wings that are like 5 stories tall. But that doesn't really do it justice. No.
4 stories?
4 stories, 5 stories.
I don't know.
But I think it was 4 stories. Yeah. Emmanuel, you're very famous, at least in hacker spheres. So you both travel around, do you get to have to answer the same questions all the time, again and again?
No, actually, I didn't have to worry about that too much. People seem to leave me alone,
really?
Which is great. I love that. being able to walk through the streets, you know, peacefully without people mobbing me. No, I don't get that at home either. It's basically, I saw a lot of people that I knew at the Congress, and it was great just to chat with them and talk with them, and that's what it should be.
So Emmanuel Goldstein isn't your real name.
It's
a nickname you picked, right?
Yes. It's a handle I picked from George Orwell's 1984,
yes.
Which I suggest everybody read.
Oh, yeah, definitely. To all our listeners, read George Orwell's 1984. Do it. Just do it.
Do it now. We'll wait for you, because it's really good.
What was your reason to pick the name of the bad guy or the...
Don't give it away. You're spoiling the ending.
Shit.
Yeah, it's basically...
Everybody has read it anyway.
You'd be surprised who hasn't read it, I'll tell you that. It just seemed like an appropriate name. Winston Smith was a bit too obvious. He was the victim of the state. Emmanuel Goldstein was the enemy of the state. But then there was questions at the end as to whether or not he really was the enemy of the state. Who was
now
he really
working
for?
Now you're giving it away.
Well, okay, but you already did, so I think I might as well. I think people should never really 100% trust anybody. Who am I really working for? Should you trust what I say? Listen to my words, but don't follow blindly. And I think that's something that you can attach to any situation.
So obviously you're a person who is very critic to the powers that be.
I've said a few critical things, yes.
Yeah. So I'm wondering how you experienced the Snowden revelations.
I experienced them with great delight. I was very happy to see this this kind of revelation from somebody who is such a pinnacle of character, somebody who knew exactly what he was talking about, wasn't shrill about it, wasn't saying, okay, this is what we have to, basically just presenting the facts, putting himself on the line, knowing what he was getting involved in, being extremely well-spoken. We, Kyle and I, had the amazing opportunity to hang out with Edward Snowden's parents during Hope X.
Whoa.
While he was giving the keynote and they were in attendance. He was on a video screen. They were there in person. But I see where he gets his strength. I see where he gets his values, because they are two of the most amazing people I've ever met. And they just basically are so supportive of him going through hell right now, but also being an incredible hero to so many. And I just wonder how many families would be able to do that. So I feel very strongly that this is the right person in the right place at the right time. And what he has revealed has shaken many people's belief in the system and educated us as to just how much surveillance is out there and what the true motivations of those in power are. Like I said, he did so in a way that was not particularly judgmental. The data itself was judgmental. He was presenting the facts, explaining it to anyone who listened. And if you really want to see something about the character of Edward Snowden, watch Citizen 4. You see him before it all hits the fan. You see him in that motel room or hotel room or whatever it was in Hong Kong.
Playing with the Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, playing with the Rubik's Cube. And you basically see who he really was. And I think it's the most incredible parallel when you look at someone like Edward Snowden saying, yeah, okay, film me. Film me as I'm sitting here waiting to find out what my fate is, as I've just revealed some of the most controversial material in the world. Parallel that to the NSA saying, keep it all quiet. Don't tell anybody anything about us. It could not be a better situation for freedom, I think.
It is known that Edward Snowden is a big fan of the U.S. Constitution. It is said he had a copy of it near to his desk. And this most likely was the reason why he did what he did, because he found out that the Secret Services were violating this constitution. So what I'd be really interested in is, what do you think have the Founding Fathers thought when they wrote the Constitution? You know, they kind of restricted it to be valid only on U.S. land. Do you think this is intended as such, or did they just not imagine that it would be possible in any time to violate human rights of people who are not on the same continent?
I think if we had them around to ask, they would certainly say that, yeah, this should extend beyond our borders when we're affecting people. There is a lot that really should be updated with such documents, insofar as what does it mean in modern times. But I honestly think that if the Founding Fathers and Edward Snowden were around at the same time, they would be getting along just great.
Mm-hmm. Do I get the right impression that you oppose the notion of that everybody outside the U.S. shouldn't have privacy?
Absolutely. Everyone should have privacy everywhere. My country can only, or should only, be able to define its rules concerning citizens within its boundaries. But obviously, what we are doing affects people of all different nationalities. And that just is wrong. That's wrong. We should not have that power. Imagine, say, a country like Iran having that power over U.S. citizens. If you feel outraged and angry, well, that's how they would feel about us doing it to them. We don't do that enough.
Right. Do you think that U.S. citizens would be outraged if they knew the Russian Secret Service are doing the same thing?
Of course. Of course.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are agreements. There are things that, as we've become a bit of a smaller place to live in space, we have agreements. Not everyone agrees to them, but I think of human rights. I mean, there are places where we try people, like The Hague, you know. There are agreements. There are things that we have as understandings as modern developed nations, and like you said, these issues need to be brought in and updated in actual laws and actual discussions, but in the right way, not in underhanded ways. These things that are counter to what the majority of people, what their will would actually be if they could make some of these choices for themselves.
And it's interesting you mentioned The Hague, because, well, The Hague, you can't try Americans there. The U.S. opposes that. And in fact, they even have a plan to invade the Netherlands if an American is ever taken and brought to The Hague. This is real.
Really?
Look it up. Ask a Dutch person. They know all about this. And there is talk now with various revelations coming out about the Iraq war and about the torture at Guantanamo. There is talk about, well, these guys should go on trial. Dick Cheney should be held in The Hague. This is talk within America and at a higher level than you might think. So it might not be realistic to anticipate that kind of a trial in The Hague, but I think we're closer to it than we ever have been.
Probably. The British Prime Minister just recently suggested that there shouldn't be any private communication anywhere in the world whatsoever where the British Secret Services are not able to phone in, to listen in, if they think it might be a terror suspect. He's basically suggesting to put away privacy for all times, because it must be strictly necessary to listen in on communication of any kind. I suppose this is quite the same thing that was once suggested with the Clipper chip, and I guess you were around at that time and very active in the discussion, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You see this every time there is some kind of crisis that can be latched onto. You saw it after 9/11, and after the Charlie Hebdo massacre. But if you look at the actual cases, mass surveillance did not help at all, could not have helped at all. And what Cameron is doing is taking advantage of people's fear and trying to push through something which goes against everything that we supposedly stand for. To say privacy is the enemy, and that is what he's saying. He's saying privacy is a threat. That is incredible. That is something that I think a lot of people are just shocked at. And imagine his kind of a world where you're not able to say anything privately, where it's all able to be read by the government. That is 1984. That's totally an oppressive regime that's able to basically spy on everyone's thoughts. And, you know, I like to say if it's possible to spy on people's thoughts, they will say we need to do that in order to stop terrorism.
Right.
If you give them this, you'll never get it back. You know, that's so important.
Well, and what I see absolutely is that in these events, we need actual investigative work. I mean, murders are murders, and crimes of a violent nature, they've been going on for quite a while. There is an industry, there is a mechanism for investigating these things. There is there are a lot of tools that people, law enforcement or governments have, and to have these reflexes to go to electronic surveillance immediately, it's just it's such a
Nietzsche creation.
Blatant, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
Nietzsche creation.
Yeah, a knee jerk, and totally blatant. In that they're basically wanting to just pull something that not a year ago was, or maybe a little over a year ago was, really making them look awful and showing them for their colors, showing them for who they are and what they want to do, what kind of world, as you said, they want us to live in, and that we can imagine, given what I think hackers understand of the technology, what actually is possible with optical communication, stuff like that, and storage and these things. And they're hoping that people latch on because people are hurt. And you know what? The government comes in, and when you're upset, when you're hurt, they're here to give you comfort, you know, and they want us to feel all comfortable by accepting these new policies and saying, yeah, you know what, I'm going to feel comfortable that you're going to get the bad guy, and it won't be used for, you know, racist policies, it won't be used for socioeconomic stuff, you know, where bankers, they don't get searched, they don't get surveyed, but anybody involved, you know, doing a little street hustling or something, you know, very minor, or they're an activist, or they're meeting up with other people because they want to protest a big company coming to their city, you know, the dichotomy, that the difference between how those technologies will be used ends up kind of being brushed aside, and it's really that we're supposed to trust the government to do the right thing, and to say nothing of the systemic problems that these leaders actually had a bit of a hand in creating. Like, they're completely ignoring the influence of our governments, the influence and the deals they've made with corporations and geopolitical, I don't know what you want to call it, the milieu, the way things are, the status quo, that they absolutely have control over, right? But for whatever reason are bought off or are in the interest of, well, we need to develop, we need to grow, you know, we need whatever it is. If you're talking about the UK, let's have colonies everywhere, right? You know, that's our prerogative. We're the United Kingdom by all means. So they're completely unjustified in rolling out these programs and basically asking us to accept their solutions for comfort and not actually look at their hand and their influence, their guilt in creating an environment where people actually want to create, they actually want to kill other people violently. I mean, if you look at crime in New York years and years ago, what, in the 80s, 90s, crack epidemic, Reagan and stuff, I mean, there was things that had influence in that. And so I think what I'm not seeing a lot of, and what really gets me when this comes up, is the solutions have nothing to do with the actual problems. And that's what I think we're saying and a lot of other people around the world are saying, but it's going to get lost. And we have got to stay close to that and know that anything they're trying to do is not the comfort we need. We need comfort and accountability from them and their ilk.
Thank you so much for bringing this up. I think it can't be reiterated often enough. It's a really very important point, Kyle. Thank you very much for speaking that one out. We are already at the end of the show, so we wanted to ask you, will you be attending the Chaos Computer Camp, Nick?
Oh, try and keep us away. Yeah, of course we're going to be there.
Oh, yes. Great.
Yeah, we've met so many people in our travels that we're looking forward to seeing at the camp as well.
I've really been honored to go to some of these things, and I just love catching up and building new relationships because we would like to just connect and be related. And a lot of that can be done virtually, but there's really no replacement for talking, meeting with people eye to eye, you know, really having an understanding and, you know, making friends. It's good to make friends, you know, it still is. So those opportunities are so great. So we'll definitely be there, and we want to.
Yeah, maybe at the Holland camp in Holland last year, there was this broadcasting station, and maybe let's do another show together in summer.
Oh, that
would
be great.
I'm looking really forward to it.
So absolutely. All the hackers out there, come to the camp, and you might get the chance to actually talk to Emmanuel Goldstein.
It's not as thrilling as you might think, but okay, whatever.
Unfortunately, we didn't get around to talk a lot of stuff like DCSS I would love to talk about, but as we are now at the end of our time, what's next for you? So are you going to leave Europe now, or are you still traveling around?
We still have to drive across Germany. We're doing that. I think we're starting that tomorrow. And we're going to wind up in Brussels eventually.
And you'll depart from Brussels then to
that's,
the US?
That's the understanding, that that's when we'll be asked to leave the continent.
When will the next hope be?
We don't know exactly the date. We never know until about a year beforehand, but it will be July of 2000. What year is this?
2016.
Okay, so it'll be July of 2016.
The next year, yeah.
Yes.
Good. Then I play the outro, and we are off. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
That was Joe and Susie.
Eine Sendung der Letznetzgemeinde.
Der Chaos Talk. Technik, Web, Politik.
Zu hören jeden vierten Mittwoch im Monat und als Podcast. Wir freuen uns über Feedback und Anregungen.
Erreichbar unter sbg.chaostreff.at und per Mail unter radio@chaostreff.at.
Beschwerden und Beschimpfungen schicken Sie bitte an spam@gmail.com.
Hey guys, Finn with you. This is WUSB Stony Brook, Finn's Revolution. Tonight, it's two words, David Bowie. I'm really not going to talk too much, except when I absolutely have to. We're just going to listen to some Bowie. If you want to make some requests, hit me on Facebook at Finn Miller. I'm the guy with the Viking hat, F-I-N-N Miller, and make some requests. Let's enjoy some Bowie.